From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and let's get straight to the economy, where the news, unfortunately, doesn't sound all that new. The Labor Department reported today that another 1.3 million people filed for unemployment last week. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. And Scott, this is the 17th straight week with unemployment claims topping 1 million. Unbelievable. What kind of trends are you seeing in these numbers?
The initial claims have been pretty flat for the last several weeks. Actually, if you take away the seasonal adjustment, which some economists suggest are distorting the picture a little bit, we actually had an increase in first-time jobless claims last week. In any case, it seems clear the gains in the job market that we were seeing in May and June have basically stalled out. As the number of coronavirus cases has surged again, of course, some state and local governments have been imposing new restrictions on economic activity. And even where they aren't, consumers are being a little more cautious about going out and spending money.
And you're keeping an eye on temporary furloughs in gig workers as well. What does that data show?
Gig workers and the self-employed usually aren't eligible for unemployment, but Congress did set up a special program that expands eligibility during the pandemic, and that's become a really important lifeline. Last week, more than 900,000 people applied for those pandemic benefits. That's down from the previous week, but it's still a lot of people who are also unemployed, even if they aren't covered by the traditional program. And between the two programs, we now have more than 30 million Americans who are receiving unemployment benefits each week.
There was a sign of hope today. Retail sales rose 7.5% in June. That was more than expected. And it's also on top of a big increase in May. How do you compare those retail numbers to what we're seeing in the jobs picture right now?
Retail sales are bouncing back. They did fall very sharply in March and April, but overall sales are now about 1% higher than they were this time last year. The shape of those sales has changed, though. Restaurant sales are lower, grocery sales are higher. Home improvement sales are way up. People are spending a lot of time at home now, and in some cases they're finding projects to work on while they're there. All that spending has been supported in part by a lot of money that the government has been pumping into the economy, including unemployment benefits. Of course, the federal government authorized an extra $600 a week in supplemental unemployment benefits during the pandemic. Those are set to expire at the end of this month unless lawmakers decide to extend them. If those benefits go away, you're talking about taking a $19 billion a week out of people's pockets.
Wow.
If that happens, of course, retail sales could take a hit, and a lot of people could have trouble making other payments, you know, paying their car payment or their credit card bill or just paying the rent.
All right. End of the month. That's an important deadline. Thanks very much. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And let's touch down now in South Florida, where hospitals are straining under the influx of coronavirus patients. Florida reported an additional 13,000 cases yesterday, bringing the state total to over 315,000. And in Miami-Dade County, some hospitals are now running out of ICU space. Veronica Zaragovia is a reporter with member station WLRN in Miami, and she joins us now. Veronica, some experts are saying that Miami is the new epicenter of the pandemic in this country. And for a while, we were seeing mostly young people getting sick there, but that's not the case anymore, is it?
Well, Peter, the problem is that when I, out of those 315,000 cases that you mentioned in Florida, the 25 to 34-year-olds outnumber slightly when it comes to infections. But when it comes to hospitalizations, then the 65 to 74-year-olds do outnumber the other patients, and that correlates with what I hear from physicians, that there are older, usually their ICUs have more older patients, but that's not to say that this is not very serious for younger people still.
Right. And what about that hospital capacity? We know from New York City, when it was going through its very tough time, that it's not just an issue of beds, but it's also an issue of staff, which I imagine at this point in South Florida are feeling overwhelmed.
Absolutely. Florida's Division of Emergency Management confirmed that they've contracted nurses so they can send them to hospitals who need them. Jackson Health System, the state's largest public health system, is receiving 100 nurses to help because they've had about 200 nurses who have fallen ill, not because they were infected in the hospitals, but in the communities. And so they've had to replace them, or others would just really need a break.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've seen that story play out all across the country. Now, back in April, local government where you are set up a field hospital at the Miami Beach Convention Center to deal with this potential surge in patients. The surge is here, but it looks like that hospital hasn't opened yet. Do you think it will soon?
Correct. It hasn't. And so far, I touched base with Miami Beach, and it's not, they think it can hold off a little longer. The problem is that if it does have to get activated, it is in an evacuation zone. And remember that we are in hurricane season. And
oh, right.
So if a hurricane were to come our way, that's one problem. There's another makeshift field hospital at the Miami-Dade County Fairgrounds, and that's more of a tent structure, so that would be able to withstand a hurricane even less.
All right. Veronica Zaragovia with WLRN in Miami. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks to you, Peter.
Adding to the misery of the pandemic, a heat wave has scorched much of the South and Southwest this week, the same areas where COVID-19 cases are surging. This combination is particularly challenging. How to help people escape the heat while also working to stop the spread of the coronavirus? Catherine Troisi joins us to talk more about this. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at UT Health School of Public Health in Houston. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you.
So we're reading that coronavirus cases are surging in Texas right now. Yesterday, there were more than 10,000 new cases and 110 new deaths from COVID-19. Those are record highs for the state. And at the same time, there's a heat wave affecting much of Texas. Are the people who are most vulnerable to becoming ill from the heat the same people who are most vulnerable to COVID-19?
Yes, unfortunately, the virus and the heat affect the same populations. These would be seniors over the age of 65, and then our communities of color who are less likely to have air conditioning in their homes, as well as the homeless who don't have a roof over their heads. So needless to say, do not have air conditioning.
Yeah, we're usually talking about cooling centers when we have heat waves like this. Many cities are still doing this, but how challenging is it to keep those types of places safe during this pandemic?
Yeah, cooling centers are an issue when you have to keep people physically distanced in order to prevent transmission of the virus. So what cities are looking at are innovative ways to open cooling centers. For example, convention centers that aren't being used right now, gyms, sports facilities, malls, for example, if they're not open to the public, would be a lot of space where you could physically distance people but keep them cool.
Are you worried about people making the choice not to go to cooling centers because of fears around the pandemic?
Yeah, especially in the elderly who may not understand that the heat is affecting them. In a typical year, we see in the United States 600 recorded deaths due to extreme heat, but there is some evidence that the actual number is over twice that, maybe as high as 1,300. So extreme heat is a public health issue.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about the effort to curb COVID-19. There are the drive-up and walk-up testing sites with healthcare workers outside, and they're wearing a lot of protective equipment in the heat. Houston had to close some of its sites early because of the heat. Can you talk a little bit about the challenge for those folks in trying to control the spread of COVID-19 and maybe some thoughts that you have on ways to continue this effort but also keep folks safe from the heat?
Houston is not only hot, it's very humid. And so your sweating does not cool you off like it does in drier climates. And so when you're wearing all of that protective equipment, you're standing outside on asphalt that radiates the heat. It can be quite dangerous. I think what we may have to look at is moving some of those testing sites inside where you could physically distance people and yet protect our testers as well.
Your call to action as folks are heading into the weekend, heading into this record heat, you know, a place like Texas, I think some folks who aren't there might think, well, folks are used to the heat. It's always hot there. But even just a few degree temperature change can really impact one's health. What would you like to say to people as they're thinking about not only COVID-19, but also keeping themselves hydrated and healthy during this heat wave?
It's important to stay out of the sun, to keep yourself hydrated. One thing that I think from a policy issue is making it safe for people to stay at home. So either giving out fans, installing window air conditioners so at least one room in the house is cool for people. Utility assistance. Sometimes people have air conditioning and won't turn it on because they're worried about the bills. But it's important to take heat seriously and take care of yourself as best as you can.
That's Catherine Troisi. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at UT Health School of Public Health in Houston. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Pleasure to be with you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
Every company wants to be a darling, especially in Silicon Valley. So in 2018, when Tristan Walker decided to move his company to Atlanta, the move seemed counterintuitive. But it was exactly what Walker envisioned. He wanted his brand Bevel, a health and beauty company specializing in razors for Black men, to be headquartered where Black people actually live. Bevel was acquired by Procter & Gamble, but Walker still serves as CEO, and he's been vocal about challenges Black entrepreneurs are now facing during this COVID-19 crisis and how all companies can do better to serve Black customers. Tristan Walker joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
So, Tristan, as I mentioned, your company is best known for the Bevel razor and shaving cream. Tell us a little about the void you saw that needed to be filled.
You know, when I think about the health and beauty space, you know, it's a space that everybody should be respected in. Everyone's unique difference should be respected. As a Black man, I have a different hair type. I have different skin type, and those needs should be respected. As I walk down retail aisles, you know, I deserve not only products that work for me, but also a design experience that doesn't make me feel like a second-class citizen.
This is really interesting because we've actually talked about this on this show. Black Americans spend about $1.3 trillion a year. That's roughly the size of Australia's entire GDP. And yet, despite having so much purchasing power, if a Black man wanted to buy a grooming product, he had to rummage around the ethnic aisle. It's the same for women too, you know, for Black women like myself, where the only choices seem to feature, as you say, a 70-year-old Black man in a towel drinking cognac while petting a tiger.
That's a fact.
It's a fact, but why do you think there's a disconnect there between money that Black Americans spend and paying attention to the needs of Black customers?
Well, I think it also goes more than just the money. Look, when you think about Black consumers, we're the most culturally influential demographic in the world. You know, certainly we over-index in spend as it relates to each of these categories as well. I think one of the big problems is, you know, these organizations that are serving the needs of this audience do not have an employee base that reflects the diversity of it. Walker & Company is overwhelming majority people of color. Black women in positions of leadership at my company is the majority of my leadership team. We reflect the diversity of the consumer we serve. You know, when I started Bevel, you know, a lot of folks would say, well, you know, Black men shaving in the United States is, you know, small market, $100 million, $200 million. We only serve kind of billion-dollar plus market opportunities. And no one really took a pause to ask, why was the market so small? perhaps the market's so small because you don't have products that serve the needs, right, of the community. Mm. And we felt that there was a wide open market creation opportunity for Bevel to really come in and serve this audience.
Hmm. I want to ask you about the difference between representation and tokenism, because it also seems like we're seeing so many companies right now in the wake of George Floyd's death doing this sort of rebranding, whether it's changing the name of Aunt Jemima, for instance, or companies with Black Lives Matter commercials. Do these actions feel meaningful to you?
I will always support progress. These are some things that, you know, should have happened a long time ago, but I'm grateful that they're happening. I also have a deep respect for the consumer, right? We get to make decisions, right, of the brands that we like to support, which brands share our values. Consumers have the power to make choices, and brands are catching up to that fact.
Hmm. We've reported on the difficulty Black-owned businesses have faced getting PPP money, which echoes this long-standing issue. I mean, the numbers are really stark. 46% of white-owned businesses can get credit from a bank compared to 23% of Black-owned businesses. What are some of the biggest barriers you see facing Black entrepreneurs and maybe the structural issues that you'd like to see addressed?
Of course. Look, before COVID-19, there are systemic issues related to access to capital, among other things. There are some 2.5 million small businesses that are run by Black proprietors. COVID-19, I mean, it's getting reported 40% of those businesses will be wiped out.
40% of businesses wiped out.
Correct. Completely wiped out. And some are already getting wiped out. That is a seismic shift, right? In access and empowerment and frankly, freedom. Really, when I think about what's happening right now, it's so imperative in an increasingly diverse country, in an already diverse world, right, to really understand that this representation is critical to America's success.
I'm struck by you saying that the success of Black entrepreneurs is directly tied to America's success. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, folks of color are going to be the majority of this country in 20 years. Folks of color are the most culturally influential demographic groups on the planet. You know, folks of color spend more money in every single category that I can think of, right, relative to other groups on the planet. This is the biggest deal, right? And I think it is the greatest opportunity, whether that be for-profit, not-for-profit, that we can really be focusing on, right, to put access, capital, opportunity in the hands of not only the cultural arbiters, right, but the folks that have a point of view and perspective for what the world needs, right? Because the world is diverse and increasingly so. This is the future.
You've been talking a lot about thinking about the consumer and the consumer's needs. Your company recently partnered with Headspace to offer free mental health services to Black people. Yeah. Why was this an important step for you to take?
Yeah, you know, when I think about what's happening, particularly over the past 5-6 weeks, right? And let's even go back 16 weeks with COVID-19. Remember, I have an employee base and a consumer base that reflects Black men, women, folks of color more broadly, disproportionately impacted by the two global pandemics going on right now with COVID-19 and also the persistent racism, right? And I have to remember that before I'm a CEO, before my colleagues are colleagues of mine, we are human beings, right, who have acknowledged a persistent trauma, right, both emotional and physical, that we've been disproportionately impacted by for the past 400 years, right, within our community. And it's important that we recognize the secondary and tertiary impacts of some of that persistent trauma. We're about personal care. You know, that also includes our mental health. So it was obvious, it was clear for us in our representation of the audience that we serve, that having access to, you know, mental health support, right, was going to be critical in order for our kind of continued success in this world.
I want to ask you about your trajectory. In your 20s, you worked as an energy trader for Lehman Brothers from 2004 to 2007, right before Katrina hit and the financial collapse in 2008. How did those years shape your view of corporate America?
It was formative for me. I hated it. You know, I was the victim of very bad culture. You know, my intention for joining Wall Street was faulty, even having the good fortune to do it. Growing up as I did, you know, I had one goal in life, and that was to get as wealthy as possible as quickly as possible because I had no access to it. And, you know, for me, there are three ways to do it. The first was be an actor or an athlete, I like to say, and, you know, I was somewhat talented in it, but not good enough. second was to work on Wall Street, but, you know, I only realized at the time that, you know, my job was to make money with other people's money to, at the end of the year, make money for myself. And to me, that was not fulfilling.
You have two young sons, both boys, I've heard you say, and you actually mentioned this about being a black man, but you said, I'm a black father before I'm a black CEO.
That's right.
You've accomplished so much. What is the future that you want to leave them?
I'd like to share this story of when Bevel got its distribution in Target stores. It was a busy time because we were launching a whole bunch of things. So I wasn't able to go to a store to actually see it, right, and experience that milestone for a few months after we launched. And I thought, wow, it'd be a wonderful opportunity for me to take my son. He was 2 years old at the time. And I took him to the store. And I put him in the cart, and we go to the aisle that we're in, right? And we turn in. And I didn't know where they were in the aisle, right, because this is my first time there. And we get halfway down the aisle. My son looks behind me, and I hear Dada with his finger pointed out. Now, I was on one of the boxes, and it was turned kind of around so you could see my face. And it was an incredible moment for me for a number of reasons. First, it was not down an ethnic beauty aisle. It was down an aisle that the products deserved to be in, right? In celebration of the efficacy, the design, and the intent of what we aim to accomplish. And it was his first time down any retail aisle. So to have that experience where, you know, he doesn't realize it now, but he will, that, you know, he gets an experience that is second to none. But even more important, when he says Dada and sees his father on the box, the founder of that company, right, the producer of it, there's an intentionality and representation that he can do it himself. And this idea of his ability to walk down aisles and be respected as a consumer, but also to be respected potentially as a producer, is why I do this every day.
That's Tristan Walker, founder and CEO of Walker & Company, known for their Bevel shaving products designed with black men in mind. Tristan, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
The Department of Affairs, Veterans Affairs in Los Angeles is trying a new way to help homeless vets. It's allowing them to live in tents on the VA campus where they can also receive much-needed services. As the pandemic continues, it's a model that could expand outside the VA. Matt Tinoco reports for the American Homefront Project.
By any metric, it's like the countless other homeless camps around Los Angeles. A collection of a few dozen tents propped up on a parking lot, most draped with blue tarps. But there's also porta potties, hand washing stations, and on-site medical staff. The tents are spaced apart, maybe about 12 feet. Lisa Tompkins is one of the only women there and has been homeless for a long time.
It's been a struggle for the last 19 years, but I'm sober today and I'm happy today and I'm walking in peace today.
She showed up after she was asked to leave one of LA's largest homeless shelters at the onset of the pandemic, where she'd been for about a year.
There was some issues with social distancing and face mask wearing, and I found myself all of a sudden without a place to go.
As a former Air Force medic, she could turn to the VA for resources. And when she showed up, she was offered a space in the camp.
They have, you know, round-the-clock security, case management on site, they have nurse practitioners on site.
Officially, the camp is the Care Treatment Rehabilitation Services Program, the CTRS in federal acronym speak. It's one of few such sites in California, basically a stopgap to give vets who were showing up at the VA asking for help somewhere to go during the pandemic. Dr. Anjani Reddy is clinical director for the LA VA's homeless program.
This really did seem like the right time to jump into action and provide the service.
In the hierarchy of basic needs, the CTRS takes care of some of the most fundamental. 3 meals a day, water on tap, bathrooms, trash services, and the security of a federal campus. None of those things are ever easily accessible for people living outside.
We continue to move them towards stable housing, but we recognize that that's limited right now and it may be limited more in the future.
Southern California's homelessness crisis continues to worsen and has jumped another 13% since last year. It has some thinking the sanctioned camp model piloted at the VA could become an option for LA's population of non-veteran homeless. That includes a federal judge who's overseeing a lawsuit filed by advocates and property owners who say LA's government has handled mass homelessness with negligence. That judge has ordered the city to shelter thousands in just a few months, potentially in sanctioned campsites. Michelle Martinez is special advisor to the court in that case.
This is a rebirth. This is a renewal. We're going to have to do things differently.
At the same time, and despite some successful experiments, many in and out of government are reluctant to embrace safe campsites because, well, it seems like giving up. The people in them are still homeless, still in tents, still outside, and still without indoor plumbing. But for Lisa Tompkins, the camp at the West LA VA is better than a camp somewhere else.
It's not ideal, no. But I'm making it work. I've got my pink comforter in here, and I got my unicorn squishmallow for a pillow.
It's a work in progress. No on-site showers mean coordinating a ride to the nearby YMCA. It took 2 weeks to figure out access to electrical outlets for charging cell phones. But for Tompkins, the camp is still a step up.
You know, I'm grateful. Rather than focus on what they didn't do, I'd really like focusing on what a benefit this is to me.
It's the simple things she appreciates the most, like a small water bottle station and easy access to ice cubes for a chilled drink. I'm Matt Tinoco in Los Angeles.
The Federal Communications Commission estimates that 18 million Americans don't have access to broadband internet, which makes remote learning during the pandemic very difficult. It is a situation that Eric Stahl recently wrote to us about. Eric lives in rural Tremont, Illinois. His daughter just finished her first year of college, and his son will be a junior in high school this fall. Eric, welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And thanks for writing to us. In fact, you wrote because you said you felt that your family's story wasn't really being represented in the news coverage that you've been hearing. Tell me more about what's going on.
Yeah, well, I listened to the show last week, and one of the administrators or educators was speaking about how it's our responsibility as parents, you know, to keep our kids safe and keep them at home. But, you know, my options at home are very limited, and my children are not getting an education home because of my lack of internet technology.
How bad is the internet connection?
It's bad. When we bought the house, you know, years ago, they said it had DSL connection, and that was enough for us. But as my kids have gotten older and technology needs more demands, the 0.4 megabit that I was getting with the DSL just does not get anything for the kids. They couldn't do their Zoom classrooms. They couldn't do anything. So we've been scrambling.
So what'd you do?
I've tried satellite. Didn't like the lag on that. At this point, I put a cellular booster on the roof of the house, and I got a hotspot through my cellular company, and we're trying that for now, but we'll see what happens when the fall session starts up.
Tell me more about what the spring was like. I mean, like, how much did this affect the way your kids could or could not go to school?
Well, yeah, I mean, the college-level education my daughter was getting, it seemed like they were prepared for this, and they had Zoom classrooms and stuff prepared. So my daughter, she had things she could do, but we literally had to shut down everything in the house for those Zoom classrooms. And she had to mute and turn off her camera in order to participate in the classes. They knew she was there, but she was like a ghost sitting in the background. My son, his Google Classroom wouldn't load at all. And the high school demands were... they were a lot less rigorous than college. It was actually kind of frustrating for me because it became kind of a point of, hey, we don't have a curriculum and the technology's lacking, so we're just going to have you mark that you're attended every day and you can keep a pass-fail grade. It was not an education.
Yeah, right. And you and many other parents across the country are probably wondering, like, how far behind are my kids falling because of this?
Yeah, yeah. And God bless the teachers, because they fell into a situation where they weren't probably ready for this either. So they scrambled in the best they could. But my son did not get an education in the spring semester. It was nothing.
What were your options? I mean, you couldn't go to a library, right? Because they were shut down.
No, and I think some of the broadband companies were offering hotspots around town you could go to, but the library was closed. What it ultimately turned into is my kids would go to other kids' houses and use their internet. And I don't know that you can argue that that's any better than them just being in a classroom.
Well, and now you have another decision to make ahead of you because the fall semester is upon us in just a few weeks, and school districts mm-hmm. around the United States are sort of giving, in many cases, parents an option. What do you want to do? Do you want to come into school? Do you want to do a flexible schedule where you do some in-classroom and some remote learning? Or do you want to do just all remote learning? What's your district doing, and what are you thinking is best for your family?
Well, see, and that's a conundrum. They still haven't told us what they're doing. We're still in this limbo. I'm an employer, too. I have high school kids who work for me, and they don't even know what their schedule is going to be like in the fall, for working. You know, maybe they can work every other day. Maybe they're going to be at school every day. And my kids, I cannot let them stay home. I'm an essential employee. My wife's an essential employee. I can't sit there and be a teacher. I wish I could. I wish I could spend time, with my kids and help them. But the fact is, I have to work every day, too.
Yeah. I understand this has made you so upset that you've considered running for office. What would Eric Stahl, the public official, do?
You know, it's funny. I'm running for county board, and I talked to all my neighbors, and everybody says the same thing. Fix the internet. Fix the electrical infrastructure. I'm only 7 miles out of a town of 16,000 people. You would think that broadband and decent electricity would be just, common. And I really realized my platform would become technological and infrastructure, because that's what we need.
Yeah. Eric Stahl in Tremont, Illinois, where a lack of broadband internet is making remote learning very difficult for him and his family. Eric, you're proof that we listen to and respond to the letters that come our way. Thanks for writing to us, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for giving me the time.
Netflix is expected to have another strong quarter in its earning report later today. Building on the billions of dollars in revenue and a surge in new subscribers, it is seen as a result of so many people being stuck at home during this pandemic. But how much of that success is due to its secretive algorithm? To try to answer that, we're joined now by Ronnie Mola, reporter for Recode and co-host of the podcast Land of the Giants. Hi, Ronnie.
Thanks for having me.
And Ronnie, you and your colleague, Peter Kafka, tried to get to the bottom of this question. We'll link to people your podcast at hereandnow.org. The first question, though, why does it matter? Why do you all want to learn how Netflix's algorithm works?
Well, first of all, just out of curiosity, I watch Netflix a lot, and it is actually pretty good at recommending things I would like. So the first part of it was just this general interest of mine of like, how does it do that? But there's also another reason why we were interested in this question, and that has to do with Netflix's original content. Netflix has been making a lot more stuff these days, so it seems less likely that the company would be interested in giving you purely the thing that you want to watch if it has to pay another company to rent that movie or TV show. That was the driving question behind why we were looking into the algorithm.
You know, one of the funny things that happens in my house in particular is that I can tell when my kids have been watching shows on my account because all the things they
ruin
love
your algorithm
show up there.
Or they ruin
the
software.
Right. Yeah. You created 2 Netflix accounts and tracked them over time to see how viewing habits changed. What surprised you about what you found?
It is surprising that it is actually so good. Like when we first started, the recommendations were just horrible, but to be fair, we had only told them, 3 different things that we'd liked. But then over time, we really did in real time see that it got better. Another interesting element to this is that it also started recommending artwork that went alongside the things that it was recommending for us also changed to be more likely for me to click on that thing. For example, both Peter and I were recommended Money Heist, and he and I have different images. Mine actually had a image of a woman in it, and his didn't. All the way down to the artwork, the order, the sort of the topics, comedies, strong female lead, things like that. Those are all customized to you.
What data is Netflix gathering about its users to be able to make those kinds of decisions?
So unlike Facebook and Google, which sort of knows everything about what you do on and offline, it knows your demographic, things like that, Netflix It says it doesn't hoover up that sort of information about you. All it knows is what you do on Netflix. It's monitoring all of the stuff that you watch, how long you watch it, what types of movies you watch, when the last time it was you watched that sort of thing. And using its proprietary algorithm, it puts you in a bucket of other people who liked this same thing or watched this same thing.
Has Netflix responded to this idea that they might be giving preferential treatment to its own content?
So, yeah, we asked them and they say that they only show stuff that they think that we're going to like the most. However, there's one small caveat to that. They say right in the very beginning when a title is new, you know, there's no way for me to know before Tiger King is out what Tiger King is, because it's not an existing title. So they said they will show it to like a few people just to sort of garner some information about that. But they, besides that, they say they don't. I don't know if I quite believe that, even after all this reporting and asking them.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Tiger King, you phrase this question of how the algorithm works as, why did you watch Tiger King? Netflix says 64 million people watched at least some of that series. I think we all kind of assume that phenomenon happened because the show caught on. What did you find?
Unclear. I think it was a combination of, there was this very, a show that could sensibly appeal to a lot of different people. It was a fantastic, interesting, weird story. And it happened during the pandemic when everyone was all of a sudden quarantined and inside. And then you also have something that's a Netflix title. So I think the truth of what, like, why we watched it is somewhere in the middle of those three things.
Mm-hmm. That's Rani Mola. She's a reporter and co-host of the Recode podcast, Land of the Giants. Rani, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Are you looking to give your dishes extra flavor this summer? Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst says, use herbs. She joins us now with some suggestions. Hi, Kathy. And I want to say, before we get started, we had a little fun with the staff on whether it's herbs or herbs. You know, it depends on what part of the world you're from, I guess.
Indeed. Hi, Tanya. I don't care what you call it, as long as you use them very amply in your cooking, because the way that herbs can wake up the flavors of even the most basic foods is really transformational. And it's not like you have to learn a new technique or you have to go buy a million new ingredients. If you have a sunny windowsill or a patio or a garden, it's not too late to get some pots of basil and lemon verbena and dill and sage and get herbs going.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the recipes you want to share with us, starting with one for roast beets that uses herbs in a couple of different ways. Tell us about that.
So I occasionally try to experiment, like every day, and I wondered what would happen if you wrapped a fresh garden beet in some foil surrounded by loads of herbs like dill and fennel and scallions. And then I took the beet greens, which are very fresh this time of year, laid a bed down, put the beets in there, threw the herbs around it, sealed it up, and popped it in a hot oven for 45 minutes or so. And when I opened this beet packet, this herb flavor just was so overwhelmingly delicious. Let the beets cool. And then I made a very simple herb butter, just mixing room temperature butter with all of those herbs, the dill, the fennel, but you could also add chives or basil or thyme. And then these hot, delicious herbs and beets mixed with this herb butter. It was just so delicious. And for anyone who thinks they don't like beets, try a roasted beet with herbs.
Oh, man. Okay, I think I'm going to try it. How long does something like this last, an herb butter?
Oh, boy. Well, what you do is you make it, you roll it into a fat cigar shape, roll it up in plastic wrap or reusable wrap. It stays in the fridge for 4 or 5 days, but you can freeze it for a few months and just slice a tablespoon off as needed. So it'll take you. And also, if you have a lot of herbs right now, it's a great way to use them up, put them in your freezer, and this winter you could take it out.
Yeah, you know, because it's so hot, I think a lot of us are looking for light summer lunches or dinners. You have a turkey wrap suggestion that also uses herbs. Tell us about it.
I do. I too have been trying to eat lighter and healthier. And that's the other thing about herbs is that they add this pow of flavor without adding a lot of fat. So in this dish, I stir fried ground turkey. You could use ground chicken. You could even use tofu with a lot of cilantro and basil and parsley, some fresh ginger, soy sauce, sesame oil. And then I served it in a big lettuce leaf, a very tender, beautiful summer lettuce, like a bib lettuce. So the lettuce becomes like the wrap. Think of a taco. And then I added rice vermicelli noodles, which you boil in water and you serve those cold, and a little dipping sauce with lots more cilantro and soy and sesame and rice wine vinegar. And it is so refreshing. It's a 15-minute dinner, and boy, it went over really big here.
I bet. It's not, you make it sound so easy. You know,
but you know what, Tanya? It can be.
It can be. You said 15 minutes. Okay, so I'm going to try it.
Okay, you know, so one maybe complaint, half hour.
Yeah, one complaint, and I'm kind of guilty of this, is you go and buy fresh herbs and you buy a bunch of them, and then you use a little when you're cooking and you have all of it left over. Any ideas for how to use those leftovers?
Well, lots of ideas. One of my favorite things I've been doing is using mint. I've done this with tarragon. I've done it with lemon verbena. Is I make a very simple syrup. And when I say simple, this is what you do. You take 3/4 cup of sugar and 2 cups of water. You bring it to a boil, let it thicken a little, throw in your fresh herbs. Let's say you use mint, and cook it for a few minutes, let it steep off the heat for 15 minutes and strain it. And then you have this gorgeous mint syrup to add to lemonade or iced tea or cocktails.
Lovely.
Or fruit salad.
Yeah,
all kinds of possibilities.
So good. We'll have all of these recipes at hereandnow.org. We're talking herbs with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya. Nice to speak with you.
Yes, and Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I thought you were talking herbs with Kathy Gunst.
I knew you were going to say
that. I couldn't resist. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.